Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Public Knowledge's Michael Weinberg, Twit TV's Ayaz Akhtar, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to talk about Britain filtering the web, France softening three strikes, Sweden wants you to ask permission, and the NSA doesn't ask at all. All that and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 216, recorded June 21st, 2013. Birthday cakes and birthday suits. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ShareFile by Citrix. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter Twill. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. Happy summer solstice. Thank you for making it part of your pagan ritual today to join us for Twill. We've got a ton of stuff to discuss. In fact, our rundown is so loaded up. I feel sorry for our panelists who've had to go through it and try and make sense of everything that we hope to cover today. But they are good sports and they're going to give it their very best. Joining us again from Public Knowledge is Michael Weinberg. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to see you again. Some good 3D printing stuff, which is definitely in Michael's wheelhouse to talk about in a bit. But first, we're going to welcome back, as usual, my co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Yeah, it is solstice time, isn't it? Thanks for reminding me. I was wondering why this day was just dragging on like this.
That's right.
Yeah. It's good to see you. Looking forward to our conversation here.
Me too. And joining us from the studio is Ayaz Akhtar, co-host of TNT and host of Know How. Any other shows you've got rattling around these days, Ayaz?
Rattling around, yes. Out there, no. So those are the two shows I will be promoting today. And also, I'll be acting foolish because I read these stories today and brain is about to melt.
Well, we'll try and put some ice on your brain and keep it in shape. Evan, I think we should follow our standing rule for the show, which is always lead with porn when we have the opportunity to do that. And we do have the opportunity today over in Great Britain. We have a lot of international stories today, too, which is always fun. In Great Britain, there is much talk and discussion and proposed lawmaking around internet filtering. And specifically, what's going to go on there is an anticipated law that will go in place by next year sometime that will require ISPs in Great Britain to have porn filters on by default so that, you know, when you subscribe to your internet service, you don't have to do anything else to it to have porn filtered from your house. In fact, you will have to do something proactively to it in order to view any porn at your house. So I'm sure that the parents of the world probably think this is a good thing, and the civil libertarians of the world probably think that this is perhaps going a step too far in deciding, you know, what sort of content is going to, by default, be allowed into people's homes. Evan, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, you can see how this could be teed up as a free speech, free expression kind of issue. It's the UK. We need to be clear about that. You have been clear about that. So we're not talking about something here in the US where the First Amendment jurisprudence would apply. But, you know, just for the sake of our discussion, let's pretend like this was happening here in the US. And I honestly don't think that this presents a problem under the First Amendment. Because as I understand the facts here, this is a default setting, something that you go in and change. So it's not like there's any be-all and end-all restriction on the type of content that's going to be made available to users of the internet. I mean, if you think about it, the way that our laws of decency are, you know, the default setting is that you have to wear clothes when you go outside, and nobody really makes much of a First Amendment, brouhaha about that. This is not unlike what Google does, for example, in image search, and I think Bing does it as well. You know, Google made a switch. It was a few months ago now, where you actually have to tell it if you're looking for porn. You know, using image search. If you do a search that would elicit, pornographic images, it won't show those by default. It's kind of like akin to what Flickr does as well. Is by default, safe search is on. Now, of course, Google and Yahoo are not the government. They're not government actors. And this is, you know, a situation where the UK government is telling people that it's got to be this way. But at the end of the day, I think this would survive a strict scrutiny analysis that you would see under the First Amendment, because this is something that's, it's narrowly tailored. And it doesn't prohibit, in the end, anybody from getting at content that they would be constitutionally protected to see. So I think this is all right. And on balance, I'm not upset about it.
Yeah, I'm wondering how accurate that is as far as Google switching something so that porn is filtered out by default. Because we recently had something come up at my son's school, and that's... one of the things that comes to mind when I read this story is they're talking about making this applicable to home ISPs. And I'm wondering, you know, how it would apply to business and educational ISP accounts too, because certainly in the educational arena, that's somewhere where you might want filtering on by default. And I'm going to crowdsource this to IRC and ask someone in there is already piping up saying, no, you still get porn results. But here's the search that was run at my son's school that definitely resulted in porn results. And so someone in IRC who doesn't have filtering on in Google or any other filter at their home and doesn't mind being exposed to some graphic sexual imagery, go into Google image search and put in the word squirt and tell me what you get, and, you know, chime in. I'll check back into the chat room. So I do think, it's my own opinion of this is that, it is difficult when you're talking about government actors and enacting a law. But as a parent, I'm happy that to see some movement toward ISPs making this on by default. Whether they do it voluntarily or under a law, I think is something that is subject to debate. Michael, what do you think about this?
I guess I'm going to have to, maybe this is my role as someone who does not have children. Mm-hmm. But I worry about it. I worry about it first in the idea of the government saying to ISPs, you have to have this kind of filter. Because I do worry a little bit more about the First Amendment elements of that. But also, when you compare it to even a Google search or something like that, Google, even if it's by default, no government intervention, let's take that part away. There is that little icon on the top that says, that reminds you every time you do a search, safe search is on, safe search is off, whatever it is. And so you're reminded when you're doing it that you have this setting set. I cannot imagine that your general internet browsing experience, if you have one of these ISPs, is, oh, well, there's a little icon that pops up to remind you about it. And then that kind of leads to the problem of all of these filters, which is, they tend to be over-inclusive. And whether or not you worry about the things that are being unintentionally excluded or not is up to you. But if you are, if you don't realize that your internet is being filtered, everything you go to on the internet is being filtered by your ISP, and there's no real indication unless you go to your online account portal, which I very rarely go to see what it is, you don't even realize what's going on. And so you have the combination of it being on by default, not necessarily having any sort of persistent notification, and the concern about overblocking. And those things combined, for me, I would be really annoyed. I understand if you're a parent wanting the option, but in my house, I don't spend all day on my computer looking at porn, but I don't see why my house, which is a house of two adults, we need to have filters imposed by default.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I just, my take on it is I want it to be easy and intuitive for people. I don't know that I want it to be imposed by the government necessarily, But I think that the reason they are going that direction in Britain is because it hasn't been easy and intuitive, and there's been no competitive incentive, perhaps, for the ISPs to do this voluntarily. My own ISP is Time Warner Cable, for example, here in the U.S., and its internet safety and parental control option is just to outsource it to McAfee. Apparently, they give you some sort of free McAfee prescription with your account, which doesn't work if you have a Mac, by the way. So, I mean, it's sort of a way for them to say, oh, yes, we take care of that, but they don't really actually. Ayaz, what do you think?
Now, you said these would be easy and intuitive if it's required by law in the UK. Is that actually in the legislation at all, or is that just what you're guessing?
I don't think the words easy or intuitive are in the legislation.
Well, that's the thing. There are lots of parent-friendly filters out there. I've got a kid, but I'm also a nerd, so I probably would be doing this myself on my router level and things mm-hmm. like that. I don't know if there's what kind of tools are going to be mandated, the exact implementation. That will make a difference. How easy is it to get to that setting? If it's hidden by default, do you have to go into the advanced settings in that account page that Michael's talking about? Because your ISP's pages are really about paying your bills. It's right up there with government level websites of like, wow, what a mess, at least in my experience with Xfinity and Comcast and Time Warner a long time ago. So if these pages are still built in these horrible ways, I don't know how easy it'll be to turn off these mandated filters. But this is something I think people could do on their own. I don't know if you need a law for it. And the people that will want to work around it will find a way to work around it, because it's not like it's being shut off from coming into the country. It's just you will not be able to see this unless you click a button.
Well, I think the big workaround will just be in the cultural ways in which porn is distributed now and how that's different than what it was 5, 7, 10 years ago. I mean, there's a lot more that's being transmitted by peer-to-peer these days. I mean, look at all the BitTorrent litigation we've seen, just kind of user-generated porn as well. The problem with sexting, it's probably, just have it on information. It's not just teenagers who are doing that stuff. So those types of things won't be inhibited at all by any kind of regulation like this that puts it at the ISP level, because those forms of distribution would ostensibly not even be triggered or wouldn't be caught up in the filter. So there's one workaround right there, just the changing norms and changing behaviors of people. This might have been effective 5, 7 years ago, but I'm skeptical that it would be all that much now.
And I would say maybe a stretch, a real stretch, but one of those things is sort of tied to the level of competition at the ISP level, right? You can imagine living in the United States or in the UK, where everyone has a choice between 5 or 10 or 15 different ISPs like it was when there was dial-up. And then if you say, oh, well, there's this one ISP and the service they offer is a filtered internet. So if you're a parent, you have young children, great, go for it. And it really doesn't impact everyone else. But when you're in a world where people only have one or two choices, if that one or two choice decides to implement this by default, that has just sort of huge knock-on effects to everyone else who isn't in that group of people who are necessarily worried.
So the IRC has reported in, my apologies to all of you, people are saying their eyes are bleeding, they're getting 100% porn for that search result. So yeah, Evan, I don't know what you think got flipped, but folks are saying, no, they're definitely people with unfiltered connections are getting back the really graphic stuff that we encountered as well for that search on an unfiltered connection. So I don't know. Do you remember what exactly you saw reported?
I don't remember. I mean, I could find it, but it was, there's a lot of terms that, like, you know, just if you typed a woman's name, mm-hmm. you know, like Jennifer or something, that, you know, used to would have elicited a lot of, pornographic images as well. And now you would need to type like Jennifer nude in image search to get those types of images that erstwhile would have shown up in the original search for Jennifer. So, I mean, I don't think that we were expected to operate under any illusion that it was going to be perfect, but it was, just a tweak in the algorithm, as I understood it, to make it, to at least mitigate this problem. I don't think anybody expected us to believe that it was going to solve the issue. But I'll report back. I'll see if I can find where that was, or, outsource it to the IRC, crowdsource it to the IRC, I'm sure somebody can find some. I think it was in 2013. It's been in the last 6 months when Google said something about this.
Right. So a government official in the UK is telling the ISPs, you know, you've gotten yourself into a situation by default where you are peddling pornography to kids in a way you never intended. So that's their justification, that if you're not going to fix it, then, you know, we're going to make you fix it. And the one thing I will say, being a geek like Ayaz is, and I do feel like parents and schools have a responsibility if you're going to be, you know, very forward looking with technology and giving your kids access to all manner of technology. You have to be forward looking in making sure they're safe too. And I think the filters have gotten much better than they were back in the days when libraries were very up in arms about internet filtering and censorship was hurled at states that enacted laws about requiring filtering in schools. Things are much better now. We use what's it called? OpenDNS at the router level. As you probably do too. That seems to work pretty well. And then if you flip on safe search in the various search engines, you've gone a good way toward addressing the problem, and you can still do research on, you know, things of a personal health kind of nature without having results blocked. So I think things have come a long way, but Evan, you're right. And I think the Ars Technica article in our show notes points out that, there are going to be areas such as Reddit, for example, that are going to be replete with porn. And because Reddit's not a site that necessarily would be blocked at the router level and doesn't have a safe search setting, you're out of luck as far as wanting to filter that. It's just going to come on through.
Right. And by the way, I found a link to an article. This was in December of 2012. There's a link at the Daily Mail, you know, incidentally, a UK source, interestingly. If you go to e74.us/XR, for those of you listening or later, there's that article, you know, to look at later when Google tweaked the algorithm to make porn harder to find. So that's what that's all about.
Well, I mean, it's good that they did it, but it looks like the tweak might have been more window dressing than anything else, if our IRC's bleeding eyes are any indication.
Or window undressing, as you may be.
Yes, as it may be. All right. Well, I don't know. Let's give the last word to Michael here. I pulled out in our rundown a quote from John Milton, who was, you know, as anti-censorship as anyone, and wrote a famous tract on the topic where he says, "It's almost as good kill a man as kill a good book. Who kills a man kills a reasonable creature, God's image. But he who destroys a good book kills reason itself."
Was that Rage Against the Machine?
it should be. Hold on, let's see. "Many a man lives a burden to the earth, but a good book is the precious lifeblood of a master spirit, embalmed and treasured up on purpose to a life beyond life." So John Milton really liked his books, but have we moved past a world where, you know, we're necessarily worrying about people being able to get themselves in print? Michael?
I don't know that we're worried about people not being able to get themselves in print. I guess the question is being in print what it used to be? You know, I think that it's great to be able to get in print and be able to circulate that. But for some people, that's enough. For some people, they say, well, I want to be in print in a place that has some sort of commercial or social validation. And so it may be that while we can all have our names on a book today, we can't all have our names on a book or on a website that feels kind of real in the way that a book would have felt, especially for John Milton. You know, a way a published book would have felt when he was writing is a slightly different animal than, you know, everyone can come out and write if they want.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this. For anyone interested in the U.S., I'm going to put a link in the show notes to the laws that govern internet filtering in the U.S. since it varies very much state by state. Different states have enacted different things. And there is a federal law that actually passed constitutional muster that requires public schools, if they are accepting certain federal discounts on their communications, to install filtering, but private schools are exempted from that. So I'll put that in for anyone who wants to check that out. Let's move on to copyright. So we've got Michael Weinberg on the show. We've got to talk about 3D printing. And in fact, there is an interesting dispute right now involving some Creative Commons licensed, are they CAD files? Is that the actual item that is licensed here, Michael?
They come in a couple different formats. These were probably technically STL files, but yeah, they're basically CAD files.
Okay.
And the virtual representation of physical goods.
And these are some really cool shapes that can be 3D printed and probably can't be created in just about any other way. And it turns out that in demoing 3D printers at places like Toys R Us to show, you know, what a great creative thing this would be to have in your household, commercial manufacturers are going ahead and using those files in their demos, even though this particular artist's works are not licensed for commercial use. The thing in question is called a braided toru. And I think we can probably, there you go. There's the printer. And then if you see, if you're watching the video, some of those little things down there on the side, they're sort of twisty and sculptural. That is the item in question. And Dizengoff, I think is the artist's name, is not happy about this. So, Michael, what sort of recourse does he have?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is a really straightforward copyright story that just happens to touch on 3D printing. But he puts his designs up on Thingiverse, which is the website that you can, why people share 3D designs on. And on that website, he makes them available under a couple different Creative Commons licenses, most of which are non-commercial. And so, well, a lot of times, I mean, I talk a lot about how there are many things that come out of a 3D printer that are not protected by copyright, in which case those licenses may not mean very much. But in the case of his work, it is purely sculptural work. There a lot of them are derived from math, so they're very kind of intricate repeating patterns, and they're protected by copyright. And so they're put up under that license. If you make a copy of that object without complying with the license, you're infringing on copyright, just like you would be if you made a copy of anything else that's protected by copyright. And so his legal options are to sue for copyright infringement. I don't know that that's the best strategy, but it's certainly an option available to him to say, look, you are using my designs, you're making copies of them, you don't have permission because you're not going with the license, and so you're infringing.
So, as you said, it's not a terribly practical solution to a lot of artists out there who may not have, you know, counsel at their disposal, funds for counsel at their disposal. Do you think this is an issue? Obviously, I don't think having the Creative Commons license on there aggravated this problem. He would have had the same problem if it were just a copyrighted work, all rights reserved. So I don't think we can point the finger there. I think, you know, the issue here is this going to have a detrimental effect on the world of 3D printing as it goes forward? You know, 3D printing is something that's always looked at or conventionally looked at as something that's going to destroy the copyright regime that we know. This sort of flips it on its head and makes you consider whether the artists in that arena are going to have incentives to keep creating if people are misappropriating their works.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it more as a teachable moment than anything else. And it's a double teachable moment. The first is that if you are going to be printing out these cool designs, and it makes sense to use them to show off the capabilities of the printers, because like you said, a lot of them are designs that could not be made through other methods of manufacture. So if you're going to do that, and you're going to do that commercially, to the extent that you are printing things that are protected by copyright, you need to be aware of that and figure out your licensing. And so that's really something that the manufacturers need to pay attention to. And most of them have legal departments, and you'd think they would be keeping an eye on that sort of thing. But the other thing is, it's sort of a moment, it's a teachable moment for Creative Commons. Like you said, this is not a situation where this is not Creative Commons' fault, and this wouldn't have been fundamentally different if there wasn't a Creative Commons license. But it's important to remember that when you see a Creative Commons license, that doesn't mean do whatever you want. It's in the public domain. A Creative Commons license is a license, whether it's on a 3D designed object or something else. And if you want to use it, make sure to look at all those letters that come after it. They're pretty straightforward as long as you take some time to understand it. And if it says non-commercial and you want to use it commercially, contact the artist. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means you need an additional set of permissions. And so just remembering the role that Creative Commons has. I mean, Creative Commons is great, but it isn't all things to all people for all situations.
Well, is this partially because of the 3D printing is so, at least the commercial level, or the consumer level, is so new that these companies aren't even thinking about talking to the legal counsel when they're just downloading files and they're saying, okay, we'll have this, we'll show it off with our Toys R Us printer. Won't this end up having, like you were saying, Michael, like a teachable moment? Won't this actually have a positive influence for more artists to be end up hired by Toys R Us or these works for hire?
Yeah, I hope it's a really great opportunity for these companies that say, well, we need content to show off the capabilities of our printers. And if we go to a website like Thingiverse, and it doesn't take very long to find the people who are doing really amazing stuff. And part of that is because of the way that Thingiverse is structured. So it really can help you find the innovators and say, okay, well, if I want to show off the capability of my 3D printer, I should find the artists that I love on Thingiverse and contact them and say, hey, I want to use your stuff commercially. Can we cut some sort of deal? So it could be a great thing for the designers once we work through this sort of initial phase.
We're going to have 3D designs with like Louis Vuitton style logos everywhere. So that way it's always marked. That's what I don't want to see.
Hey, Michael, in IRC, folks are bringing up Jay Leno 3D scanning and 3D printing out old manufacturing car parts. Is this something you've paid attention to?
Yeah, it's cool. He's actually been doing that for a long time because he, as a lot of people know, has some massive garage deep in the bowels of the earth, and he has all these old cars. And so when you have old cars and you need to replace the parts, you know, if the manufacturer doesn't exist anymore or something, you can print out the old part, because we see a lot of the 3D printers that print in plastic, but there are printers that print in metal. And so print those replacement parts. And so while he's been doing it at his garage for a little while, they're now, I'm starting to hear from and see more companies, and some of their business model is, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to get 3D scans, 3D models of every part you would need if you are rebuilding, you know, this whole list of old cars. And so you could see a point in the future where you're rebuilding a car, you're rehabbing a car, and you say, well, I need this piece and it doesn't exist anymore, but I can just download and print it and go with it. And so it's really neat from that application standpoint. And then if you think about it, if you are an IP law nerd, mm-hmm. you can think about it and say, well, wait, wasn't this copyright infringement? And for a lot of the parts on a car, those parts are not protected by copyright. They may have been patented, but if you're restoring a car from 1952, those patents expired. And so those parts are in the public domain. And so you can download them and print them and do whatever you want with them. So it's a really interesting angle to think about an application of 3D printing for this world of basically machines that are being restored by people and they need random custom bits. That's exactly what 3D printing should be good for.
All right. Well, that seems like an interesting thing to keep an eye on too, because somebody's going to find a way to sue over that. Even if there's no existing copyright and patents have expired.
I don't know why you would think
stay
that.
Stay tuned. It's just inevitable. What wasn't inevitable, but is happening anyway, is the French. Here we go with another journey abroad for us in the United States. The French, as folks may know, have this law called Hadopi, which is their three strikes program. And it has been in place now for, I think, a few years. But they are definitely backing off of it at this point. They just imposed, in the few cases that have gone to trial, they've had their very first one where someone was actually cut off from their internet service for repeated warnings and failing to comply, and then finally got the ultimate penalty of being cut off. Well, it turns out the ultimate penalty was only for a couple of weeks anyway. And in the meantime, the French government officials, from the president to the person in charge of cultural policy, have all been saying, you know, we're definitely going to tweak this law a bit. There's a good story in the New York Times giving the details and the statements of President François Hollande and others about the fact that, first of all, the cutoff is going to go away, that penalty won't be there anymore, and that the fines will probably go down too. So apparently they've just found this unworkable and expensive and are going to be doing some tweaking to the three strikes regime that's in place. And in reading through the New York Times article, it's kind of creepy when the French start talking like this. If you cannot chop off a few heads, as an example, then the chopping machine inspires less fear, said Jeremy Zimmerman, spokesman for La Quadrature du Net, a group that has campaigned against the law. So upshot here is they've sort of been the test kitchen for three strikes, and the chopping in their kitchen is getting chopped. I think I've got to let that metaphor go at this point. So, Evan, what do you think this means for, say, graduated response here in the U.S.?
I don't know. You know, it was really weird when I was talking a while ago. You see, I'm doing the show today from my chateau in the south of France, and I just got cut off. And then, you know, I got a notice from Hadopi that I was back on. So I don't know what it's all about. So, I mean, clearly, you know, France was the leader in kind of pushing this idea, actually making it real, like all the way back in 2009, right, is when this was first implemented in France. And so this whole notion of essentially graduated response to what was going on there, very punitive measures. We talked in the show in the past. I think Terry Hart was on the show with us once when we were talking about this. And, you know, there were cracks that started to form in the wall pretty soon with Hadopi, the least of which were not the kind of the non-enforcement of it all. So I think that what we see here, the lack of any meaningful way this is being executed, really calls into question this new set of tactics that content owners are using to go about fighting so-called privacy. I mean, I look at really as there have been two different strategies or set of tactics that big content has used in the last 10, 11 years, you know, with since peer-to-peer distribution and broadband, you know, more homes having broadband, more users having faster processors, more storage space, more broadband. The first was you know, litigation, which was, you know, there were two headings under that, going after the centralized providers, the Napsters of the world, the Groksters of the world, and also going after the big campaigns of going after the individuals. Well, that, you know, when it got to be 2008, we realized that the big content realized that wasn't effective. So it taught more of this cooperative, collaborative way of approaching it through education and through these punitive measures that only come in after a while. And I think the failure in France for this to have any meaningful difference, and the decision by the French, those who are in charge of seeing this done in France, to be pulling back on it, really calls into question at a fundamental level whether this other set of tactics is going to work to fight against so-called piracy, which then in turn may then present the real essential question here: is piracy all that much of a problem? Are these efforts just solutions looking for a problem, or really is there a problem here that now a new set of tactics needs to be put in place?
But this was a great experiment. It was that with the French music business, they said that's trouble because the SNEP, that French recording company group, found out that revenues declined by 6.7% while Hadopi was going on, and digital outlet sales were down as well. So that means if you do try to curtail this, the whole industry suffers. I'm just looking at that as piracy isn't a problem. It's actually really helpful when it comes to getting that music out there for people to listen to. Back when I was in college, you'd listen to music on Napster, but eventually you go, you know what, I might want to buy this because I really like the album or I really like the artist and I want to give some money to this person. To see this thing actually implemented in France and have a decline in revenue because there's no more piracy, so nobody's buying anything. So it's a very strange turn of events if this is how these things work out.
Well, and go ahead.
No, you might.
I was going to say that there's one other strategy besides the sue everyone and the educate people and threaten to kick them off the internet, and that is make your stuff available for sale online. And of the three, that seems to be the one that actually works. And so, you know, you hope that as experiments like this fail, we see more effort put into building platforms that give people a way to actually just buy the stuff so you can, instead of spending money to fight the internet, make money off the internet.
Yeah, it seems like the argument that would be made counter to what Ayaz is saying is, well, you know, the piracy has damaged us so much in the past that we're having a terrible time digging out of that hole, even in putting these more stringent measures in place. But I'm not even playing devil's advocate. I'm just, you know, uttering the argument that we've heard uttered before.
Well, everything ruins the music industry, right? Everything. If there's too much piracy, there's not enough.
Right.
We stubbed our toe today. So something horrible always messes up the industry.
Yes. And goodness knows they need their toes. All right. This is a funny little case I put in because it's emblematic of how copyright and the web can clash with each other. BuzzFeed has been sued for $3.5 million roughly over a soccer photo that it put on its site and then pulled down in response to a takedown notice from the photographer. But the photographer in his lawsuit, he's representing himself and in his pro bono capacity, has done everything that he could think to do to ready his case, registered the copyright in the photo, and then went after BuzzFeed, even though they took the photo down, because his theory seems to be kind of a popularity tax, that because lots of people see BuzzFeed, that made the existence of his photo known to others. And then those others also picked up and used the photo. So his theory against BuzzFeed is that they are responsible for every single use of that photo and owe damages for all those uses. Now, Evan picked up on the fact that aside from the fact that their copyright law doesn't really function that way, you can't just be held liable for more damages simply because you happen to be more your use was more widely viewed than somebody else's might have been. But there's a math error going on here too, isn't there, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, and this is a rookie mistake and not entirely unreasonable. You know, statutes aren't written very clearly. And but what he needs to do is go read 17 U.S.C. 504 C1, which talks about the calculation of statutory damages for copyright infringement. And assuming that the works are timely registered, you know, before the infringement begins, or, you know, within 3 months of the first publication, you know, there's all that whole calculus for figuring out whether it's timely registered to help one or to make one eligible for statutory damages and the recovery attorney's fees. But the not entirely uncommon error that goes into some of this analysis when people are, you know, get their calculators out and think about how much money they can make by suing someone is the fact that statutory damages are awarded based on a formula that is derived from the number of works infringed, not the number of times that the work is infringed. So we've got only one work at issue here. So even on a an exceptionally wonderful, great day when Saturn and Neptune and all the other planets are perfectly aligned, and the judge had, you know, taken some kind of narcotic before coming to the bench that day to, do a damages calculation. If you were to get $150,000, you know, that would be the best of all circumstances for the damages on this because of one work at issue, not because if you do the math, he's claiming that 23 works have been, I think it's 23, right? I know the math worked out when I did it, but I'm terrible at arithmetic on the fly. But he's claiming that 23 works are infringed. If you multiply that number by 150,000, you get to that 3.45 million number. I hope my arithmetic's working out. But you can see that you can kind of reverse engineer the data in the article and see that that's the calculation error that's going on and making him woefully too optimistic in what's going on here.
I wonder if this is a really savvy settlement strategy because, you know, if he was the dude who was selling suing BuzzFeed for $100,000, you know, great, he'd just be some guy, get in line. But as the guy who's suing BuzzFeed for $3.6 million, that may get their attention and say, look, we just need to settle this and get this case done and out of the way. So he may have stumbled into a really great idea by messing up that.
Well, nobody should be fooled. Let's do everybody a favor and not let that strategy work, because this is just silly. I mean, it's just a clear, inexcusable misreading of the law. Sure, he gets our attention, but I think he's getting our attention for the wrong reasons, mainly for being worse at math than I am. And I was a philosophy major, for crying out loud.
All right. Well, in a moment here, I want to shift our copyright discussion over toward the entertainment industry and something specific to that arena. But we're here with Michael Weinberg, Vice President of Public Knowledge, IAS, another host here on the TWiT Network, Evan Brown from Info Law Group in Chicago, and me. And we're here because of the good graces of ShareFile by Citrix. You know, in business, we are constantly collaborating with coworkers and clients, sharing files like contracts, spreadsheets, presentations. It's essential that these important files are kept safe, secure, and under your control. That's why I recommend ShareFile by Citrix, the easy-to-use business solution that allows you to exchange files quickly and securely. ShareFile is perfect for sending everything from legal files to confidential contracts and financial documents. Specifically, I use it to share pleadings and contracts and all manner of stuff related to my work, and specifically things that I know might trigger an email bounce back, whether it's a big PowerPoint kind of presentation with a lot of imagery or a video file, etc. When I've got to make sure that that has gotten there, and I need to know that it can be viewed and worked on and marked up and gotten back to me, ShareFile is the way to go because I'm not going to get a bounce back. It's sent as a secure web link so that bounce backs just become irrelevant. You can control who has access to your files and the levels of permission they have. It syncs automatically, so you and your team always have the most current and updated materials. And you can access ShareFile from anywhere, your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone. You can work on the go and get everything done. Yesterday, I was, summertime has hit. I was down on the beach with my iPad doing a bunch of stuff, and ShareFile worked great, you know, over my 3G connection on my iPad 2. No hitches whatsoever. So I want you to try ShareFile for yourself. Don't just take our word for it. Really go out and kick the tires yourself. Let us know how you like it. You can sign up today, receive a 30-day free trial with no obligation. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. Remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TWIL. Thank you so much, ShareFile, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's continue on with some entertainment stories. From time to time, we check in on internet radio and the strange world of royalties and licensing in which they must conduct business. And the most interesting current development on that front is Pandora, which has bought a terrestrial radio station so that it can be, what is the word I am looking for? It can qualify for some licensing that otherwise would not be available to it as a purely internet-oriented radio station. So this FM station that it bought is in South Dakota, and they actually plan, interestingly enough, to try and bring their brand of personalized music experience to a broadcast radio station, which I think it will be interesting to see how they try and play that out. Are they going to let every audience member somehow enter thumbs up and thumbs down on their programming? Perhaps. But they're very proud of their music discovery service and the way that they associate music files with one another, the Music Genome Project that they use. And so they're fighting fire with fire by buying this radio station. What do you think about this, Michael?
Well, this is one of those great examples. Whenever someone, back in the day, when someone first taught me music copyright, they basically said to me, the less it makes sense to you, the closer you are to understanding it. And I think this is one of those great examples of how that works. I mean, this is insane, right? So the reason Pandora is doing this, besides bringing a one-to-one technology to a broadcast world by giving everyone the same personalized audio, is because there are two classes of licensee, at least two classes for a licensee for online music services. One for music services that happen to also own a radio station, and ones that don't. And the own a radio station version is cheaper. And so the economically rational thing for them to do was to buy a radio station in South Dakota to get into that lower class. I mean, that is as insane as it should be. You know, you need to, if you're going to have different license classes, you should have different classes for different uses, not for different economic configurations. And so it should be an embarrassment for ASCAP, who is the licensing organization, although I don't know if they're capable of that at this point.
Well, we covered the story on Tech News Today, and one of the things that I found interesting about the purchase is that it's the savings for Pandora, even though they get a lower rate for royalties on playing music, they only save like 1%. So it seems like Pandora wanted to make a big statement saying, hey, look how crazy this has to work. If we have to buy this just to qualify to lower our rates, why on earth are we not treated like everybody else? Now you have to deal with us. And I think BMI sued them right after this, calling it a stunt. So it's a very interesting move by Pandora to do this, but it just seems like it's more of a statement more than it is logical for the business.
Yeah, I don't know how that lawsuit has any prayer of going forward if they actually, you know, start to operate and put programming on the radio station, and it sounds like that is their intention. Evan, what do you think?
Well, I think it's probably a stunt, you know, because based on what Ayaz just said, I didn't know that, 1% figure there, but maybe I'm just being a little bit cynical because I see other stunts. We just got through talking about that other, other case where that guy's suing, for $3.45 million. Michael suggested that could be a way to get attention. I would say it's a stunt. And then I hope at some point today we talk about Google filing the motion in the FISA court about, this First Amendment thing. That's a stunt as well. So maybe I'm just in kind of stunt mode when it comes to this stuff, because clearly maybe it's not so much a stunt, but there certainly is a motive behind it to make some kind of statement. Maybe it doesn't deserve the negative connotation of being a stunt, but because, you know, Pandora has probably little interest really in expanding into the market, the radio market of South Dakota. So clearly there is a statement to be made by it. And, you know, if these companies, these parties who do these things, there's no mistake that they're doing it to advance their own interests. And in the meantime, maybe point out some kind of disparity or some kind of negative treatment that they're getting. But certainly it's in Pandora's interest to do something like this to draw attention to it.
Well, let's make Evan's stunt double our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are listening to the show for continuing legal education credit or education credit in another field, we put these phrases in so that you can demonstrate to whatever oversight board you may be dealing with that you have listened to the show. So there will be another one coming before we wrap things up. And if you need more information about education credit for the show, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find the Twill page and you'll find lots of information there. Let's move on, I believe, to another story that I put in, Michael, because Gigi Sohn is tangentially involved here, who is one of the founders of Public Knowledge, correct?
Who is my boss, yes.
Who is your boss. And apparently she was giving a talk at the World Creators Conference, the World Creators Summit, which I remember seeing a week or so ago, maybe, was all over Twitter. People definitely having a lot of conversation about what went on there. But she was giving a talk and she made reference to gatekeepers and suggesting that gatekeepers to content. This is the World Creators Summit, bear in mind. These are people who want to get their works out there. They actually hissed and booed Gigi for suggesting that gatekeepers were a problem. Were you there, Michael, or were you paying attention to this?
I wasn't there. I was here when she got back. And I think it was, my impression from her was it was sort of, it was not intended to be a controversial statement. It was kind of like an early introductory. I think it was in the context of explaining what Public Knowledge does as an organization. And one of the things that we try and do is reduce the power of gatekeepers to slow innovation and creativity. And I think that was the kind of line that got a boo and that got booed and hissed from the crowd. And yeah, I mean, you know, Gigi is a tough lady, and not a lot surprises her, but I think she was genuinely surprised to get that reaction. I think she was ready later on to get a little bit of flack from the crowd, but at that point, I think she was totally surprised by it.
Yeah, it seems very counterintuitive that audience would be of a mind that gatekeepers are healthy for their economic well-being in the future. Ayaz, are you surprised by this?
A little bit I guess I wouldn't expect that audience to do what they did, but sometimes it's you kind of flip a coin how helpful gatekeepers are. In certain industries, they actually are intensely necessary. And other times you look at something like the music business and you're seeing artists basically sign away their whole lives, the royalties, everything to these bigger companies. And you need these gatekeepers because they are already in charge. And as they are in charge, you can't get into the business otherwise. So it's this, I don't know if all gatekeepers are evil across the board. So I don't know what to expect or what Gigi Sohn should have actually expected at the summit.
Yeah, in his article writing this up, Mike Masnick at TechDirt had a really nice sort of continuum approach to this problem that, you know, on the one side, you've got folks who are really controlling and locking up access. And then the other side, you have innovators and enablers there's every point in the middle, you know, and that sometimes an entity could be a gatekeeper and then act differently than that in another way or in another facet of their business. So I like the recognition that, you know, this is not a clear-cut problem and that there are different approaches and points on the continuum. Evan, any thoughts?
Yeah, just that right there. I mean, that it is a continuum and that any kind of discussion like this is, we're not going to serve ourselves well if we look at it as some, you know, binary where you're either a gatekeeper or a, what's the other one? Enabler.
An enabler.
Yeah, yeah.
Which in other contexts is a bad, bad thing.
right. You know, it's gotta get out of our, 12-step programs here and get into the real substance of it here. So, I don't think it's helpful if we're going to just look at it as you're either in one camp or the other. And, you know, we got to make these assumptions that, again, here's my motif for the day. These parties are all going to act in their self-interests first. And the overall health of the economic context and the industry ecosystem in which they're operating second. So, you know, it's very easy to see how one could be characterized as an enabler at a certain stage in technological development and in the development of distribution modes. But then much later, once it becomes the incumbent, to take a much more aggressive and self-preservationist type of stand and thereby harm the larger public interest in all of this, and thereby, you know, come to the ire of commentators like Mike Masnick.
Okay, well, speaking of stunts, Evan, and we do have a lot of stunt-oriented topics in the show today. How about this lawsuit against Warner to pay back millions and millions of license fees paid to Warner over the years for the song Happy Birthday, which Warner has always asserted it has the copyright to. There was a outfit out there doing a documentary film and has gathered a whole bunch of evidence about the origins of Happy Birthday, going back to little songbooks for school children in the 1800s and Good Morning to You, and how that might be the basis for Happy Birthday, and has really built quite a case that Warner doesn't have the copyright to Happy Birthday to You at all, and has filed a large lawsuit against, and it's a class action suit, so everybody who's ever had to pay license fees to Warner to use Happy Birthday would be a class member. What do you think? I mean, this is not a taco suit, but a birthday cake suit, perhaps.
No, this is great. There are two great things about this. The first of mm-hmm. all, the first one is that this is a wonderful examination of very arcane Byzantine issues under the 1909 Copyright Act and whatever it was that came before that. I think it was the Copyright Act of like 1832 or something like that. So, wow, what's not to like about getting into those issues, those difficult legal issues, and then some obviously convoluted factual issues and evidentiary issues from documents from, you know, 1893 and all that stuff. So that's great. I think the other great thing about this, which is even greater, is that, you know, there are some people out there really chasing down these fundamental questions. You know, there are people who are looking for Amelia Earhart's airplane. You know, the FBI is looking for Jimmy Hoffa's, wherever Jimmy Hoffa is. And then there are people who are finally trying to get to the bottom of the copyright status of Happy Birthday to You. So the larger thing is that, you know, we're going to hopefully have some answers to one of the most important questions of our time. So I can't wait to see how this litigation pans out.
Well, I do think it is going to be fun too. Any thoughts on this, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great lawsuit. If you have been hanging out in copyright circles for at least the last couple of years, there has been a pretty robust discussion that about the copyright status of Happy Birthday and if it's not actually protected by copyright. And remember, if it's not, then Warner is basically getting millions of dollars a year. This is chump change. Just mm-hmm. kind of because they're so big that everyone is afraid to sue to push back on them. So I'm glad to see that this suit is going forward. I don't know. I haven't researched it enough to know the merits. But if it is true, then, you know, Warner is basically acting like a troll because they have nothing. They're just sort of intimidating people into pay. And it would be a great thing for justice to be served. If it, you know, if it turns out that Warner is in the right, then they'll carry on on their merry way.
The lawsuit has just been filed. It's pending in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York. There's not even been a response to the complaint yet, but we will keep you posted. I think it looks pretty interesting.
I'm really glad that the person suing had to pay Warner a license for, because she's working on a documentary. Because mm-hmm. she had to pay, she does have standing. I mean, if somebody did this a while ago, I would think the courts, they don't want to touch this because, like Evan was mentioning, this is a really old law. And it's got a whole bunch of years going on that royalties would have to be paid back. And you know how sometimes courts go, oh, no standing? We don't have to make an opinion at all. So get out of court. But they're standing here, so we're going to get some answers.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on it. Let's look at one other. I mean, this is definitely a stunt, but it made my week. We haven't had a good litigating in public story for a while, Evan. This was written up over at Gawker. It involves a small website called westorange.info as a place to provide some information about West Orange, New Jersey, where Thomas Edison once lived. And the city of West Orange decided that it wanted to have the domain westorange.info and came after this person who was maintaining this very small, simple site. And rather than just rolling over and giving up the domain and going, yeah, you know, the city wants the domain and goodness, they have sicked their lawyers on me. The person in question, the defendant, the would-be defendant, there's no lawsuit over this yet. It was just a cease and desist matter. Hired a lawyer who is now one of my favorite lawyers on the planet. His name is Stephen B. Caplet. And he penned a letter on June 17th, 2013, back to the attorney for the township of West Orange. That is a thing of beauty. I want to have it 3D printed in all of its dimensional glory and have it as a sculptural work in my office. It's just wonderful. I would read the whole thing to you, but it is very, very long. Suffice it to say that he begins, Mr. Caplet begins by telling the attorney for the township of West Orange, thank you so much for this wonderful joke that you've shared with us, because that's clearly what your letter must be. And he goes through all the reasons why the letter has to be a joke. Now, had you intended your letter to be taken seriously, here's how we would have responded. And he goes through all the reasons why the city is wrong to demand the domain back from his client, and ends by pointing out that westorange.gov is still available and why shouldn't they just go get that? And he does so in such a clever way that, you know, he does some sort of trade-off between back property taxes he claims the city personally owes him, that he'll fork over the westorange.gov domain. I'm not doing it justice, but it did make my week. So definitely check it out and read it yourself. How about this stunt, Evan?
This was good. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those situations where, gosh, you know, I wish I could have that kind of creativity to come up with something myself if I've ever gotten to this situation. But yeah, attorney Stephen Caplet did a great job in capturing this and really spinning it around and, turned it on its head. So, I like it. Glad to see that it happened. I mean, it's something that you got to do sparingly. As legal counsel, occasionally it's going to be relevant. I think we've talked about funny responses to cease and desist letters before, and even written by clients. You know, like the guy who's in charge of the oatmeal. Is a real master. Is very masterful at responding to legal threats like this. So yeah, this is a genre that is very rarefied, very refined. One that we should all be cautioned to engage in sparingly. But occasionally there's some good ones.
I asked, are you an aficionado of this genre as well?
I read this particular cease and desist, and then the response, and the response was just brilliant. The idea that that anyone would confuse westorange.info for a government site, the responding attorney was quite funny, saying it was like almost it's so minimal it could probably be called a work of art. It just has so little on it at this website. It cracked me up because, you know, somebody's got to stand up for some of these ridiculous things happening. It's westorange.info. This is a government agency or a government that could have bought the .gov West Orange URL. So it's just strange to come after this. And I liked that in the letter, he asks, I assume you went after all these other URLs that had very similar language in a westorangeinfo.com and such as those things. So I don't really think West Orange, New Jersey is getting any favors by this thing getting so public, though.
At the end of that list of other domains, he throws in westorangemassagetherapy.com and says, hopefully not a euphemism, suggest you investigate.
Yeah, maybe we should do an image search on that and see what happens.
Yes, maybe we should. He's talking about the, as you said, Ayaz, the how you could never confuse this with an actual government site. Again, grousing about the taxes he's paid or the taxpayers of West Orange have paid, $35,000 plus an additional $5,000 per year for their actual website. By contrast, my client's rudimentary website cost $3.17 free hosting is so minimalist that it arguably qualifies as modern art. And then he footnotes that and says, Jake swears that was his actual cost. Looking at his website, I believe him. Just yeah. The funniest darn letter. Michael, any thoughts?
No, I mean, I do. At the end of it, where he brings in this like bizarre personal property tax issue, I didn't know what was going on with that. I mean, it was sort of like, okay. But yeah, no, it was great. Those letters are easy to mess up. You know, going for the hilarious response is a target that is easy to miss, but great when you hit. But now we have three stunts on the show, all of which aren't really stunts, right? They're standing up to bullies or people who are being jerks with lawyers. So good for all of them.
Exactly. Well, someone else was trying to do something similar with Twitter. We've had this on our list for the last few weeks to talk about and haven't gotten around to it, but it goes so well with this story. I thought I'd just bring it up and I think it was someone on Twitter who tipped us to this, that there is an individual who had @SunValley on Twitter. So this points up the distinction between domain names that are arbitered by ICANN and have various rules that apply to them, and then subdomains like your Twitter handle, which, you know, at best would be governed by Twitter's terms of service. This person had a similar kind of Twitter account where he was putting up information about Sun Valley, Idaho. And Sun Valley, the resort, came to Twitter and said, we'd like to be Sun Valley. That's our trademark. And so please fork over the name to us. And now the original person is tweeting as I was Sun Valley and is very upset about this. But he probably has no legal recourse here. Correct, Evan? In contrast to our West Orange guy.
Right. I mean, gosh, you really got to do feel bad for this guy because, you know, we all love those of us who use Twitter, we love our Twitter handles. I would be, you know, really, really angry if Twitter unilaterally took my Twitter handle from me and gave it to someone else just on some kind of discretion that Twitter was exercising there to do that. But, you know, they reserve the right to do that in their terms of service. Section 8 says we reserve the right at all times to suspend or terminate users and to reclaim usernames without liability to you. So ostensibly, you know what you're getting into when you sign up. You know that it's a risk that you're really doing nothing more than you're no more than dust in the wind. You know, when it comes to your Twitter handle, you can kind of just be pulled away at any time. So, you know, alternatively, then, is there anything else that that a Twitter user could do in a situation like this? And I think he's out of luck, at least in the U.S. law. I was kicking it around a little bit because it seems like, you know, if somebody does something in reliance on a future state of affairs. Like, you know, if you put all this effort and energy into building a Twitter presence and Twitter allows you to do it and you learn to have this expectation that it's going to be around for a while, it seems like this equitable concept of estoppel ought to come in at some point. And, you know, shouldn't Twitter be estopped from taking away the fruits of these things that this user has done in reliance, whether that reliance really belongs there or not, of, you know, on that reliance of being around for a while. And, you know, I'm talking about something here for the next 30 seconds. So I'm talking about something I really have no idea about, which is not all that different than the other parts of the show. But under American law, I think you'd be out of luck. I don't think the law of promissory estoppel or equitable estoppel would come in and help us here. But I ran across this concept of proprietary estoppel, which you hear about under British law, which is when you do something, usually with you know, property, go in and make improvements on it with the expectation that it's going to that you're going to have superior rights to it someday, and then though that someday never comes, then you have this cause of action, this equitable cause of action here, or, you know, in a situation like that. It seems like there could be something like that here, but then again, we have to go all the way back to what the terms of service say, which first of all, make it so that contractually there's no obligation on Twitter's part that's being violated here. And moreover, it seems like those terms would put the user on notice of this possibility that this property could be taken away from you, which would undercut any argument of reliance that you would have to be successful for an estoppel argument like this. So I think we all just need to be aware of our ephemeral nature when it comes to being on Twitter, and just probably learn to live with that, as disconcerting as that may be for us.
Now, this story freaked me out because I have @Ayaz on Twitter, and there's a popular musician whose stage name is Ayaz. So I get tweeted about his performances all the time, and I have to explain he's @AyazLive. Now, he's probably got more resources to contact Twitter to get in and maybe take this name from me, but this is my legal name. So I'm just kind of curious if that makes a difference at all, because Sun Valley, the guy who was in Sun Valley, that's obviously not his name. But I'm like, oh, great, I could lose my username at any time, because, of course, I read all the terms of service and I said, okay, at Twitter, like everybody else does. And I thought this is temporary. So I will be saying goodbye to my name soon.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd be surprised if you had to say goodbye to your name. I mean, I think Twitter would get some very bad PR if it started, you know, deciding, well, this Ayaz is more popular than that Ayaz. So we're going to
I've been Ayaz longer, too. I've been Ayaz for 33 years, and that guy's only been Ayaz for about three. So it's mine.
All right. I agree. It's yours.
Thank you.
Well, we'll have to see what happens with that. But I'd be surprised if they took it from you, Ayaz. Michael, any thoughts on any of this?
No, I mean, you know, you play with a private service and they're going to, you know, treat you as they wish. I think, Evan, that was a pretty spot on legal analysis, much, much more in depth than I could have come up with. So I salute you.
Yeah, I need to get out of the house more often.
Saluting Evan. Definitely. Let us move on to what has taken up much of our time in the last couple of weeks of shows, and we have put toward the end of the show here some privacy stories. All right, Evan, you've already called this a stunt, as though you don't think that Google is serious about wanting the FISA court to allow it to publish in the way that it has received permission from the FBI and CIA to publish the numbers relating to national security letters, that it wants to be able to do the same for FISA letters, and has filed a First Amendment lawsuit asserting that it needs to be able to clear its name about what it is doing and correct some things that have been reported in the media relating to the way that it handles customer data and responds to government requests. So it has filed this First Amendment challenge. And Evan, you think it's all about PR and public opinion?
Well, I don't want to be cynical anymore today. You know, this episode and last week I was all cynical, and you know, sometimes it just makes me tired sooner than I need to get tired in the day. So I'm just going to say there are two ways of looking at this situation with Google filing this motion or petition, whatever you call it, because it's in front of the FISA court. It's not like I don't know about the rules of procedure there, but it's not like they filed a complaint or anything like that. But they're asking for some court sort of declaratory relief from the FISA court, allowing them to be more transparent with the public about the nature of the disclosures that are being made here. So there are two ways of looking at it. The pro Google stance is that, oh, look at how Google is all about transparency. And, you know, it issues these transparency reports and it cares so much about us that it wants to inform us so that we feel safe using its services. And then here's the line where cynicism kind of comes in. Oh, and, you know, serve us more relevant ads. So we want people to feel comfortable disclosing a bunch of stuff to us because we want people to feel safe that we're not just in the back pocket of the Obama administration like Eric Schmidt so often finds himself. The other way of looking at it is just that the continuum of that talk right now, which is presenting the question, Google, why now? Why are you doing this now? You know, this is very interesting that you're choosing to take this action now in light of the Ed Snowden disclosures. There's no reason you couldn't have tried to, you know, petition the FISA court to do this earlier. It's just now it's much more convenient because it looks like you know, you're doing something in the public service to backpedal from or to distance yourself from the negative PR that you've gotten. But, you know, I think that we can kind of wise up to that as observers of this and recognize that Google is in damage control mode here trying to do this. So it's, you know, it's a minimal cost for Google to do something like this. It's really a no-lose proposition for them. So what if the court turns them down? You know, they win either way. Either they'll be successful on their petition and they can be more transparent with us, or they lose, but they can at least go and say, oh, look how we tried, but the government shut us down. But, you know, we're here pulling for you. So those are the two ways of looking at this issue that I see. I'm sure there are others.
The thing I find interesting about this is Google arguing that it has, it's trying to exercise its freedom of speech, First Amendment rights under the First Amendment, obviously. And it is acting as a corporate figure. So those sorts of entities are treated very differently under the law for First Amendment purposes. And as you say, Evan, it's a pretty brief document. They haven't, you know, gone into any sort of legal detail about, you know, the basis for the legal basis for their arguments here. But it would be interesting if they went down that road, because there's some very nuanced decisions that restrict corporate speakers from having a whole lot of First Amendment protection when compared to individuals. Michael, any other thoughts about this?
No, I mean, I think I take both of Evan's points, which is that, you know, with that he made. I think when I think about this, everyone involved in this spying situation annoys me on some level. Mm-hmm. But accepting that kind of we are where we are now, anything that somebody does to help bring some level of transparency to it is commendable. And so if doing this is a step in that direction, whatever is truly motivating it is something that I'm glad is happening. You know, I wish things had happened earlier. I wish all sorts of things were different. But considering that we're in the world that we're in, I'm glad that there are steps being taken towards transparency, however large or small they may end up being.
Ayaz?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if in the filing, does the lack of actually arguing First Amendment specifics, does that mean this looks more like a PR move than anything? Because that filing was public. They could have put mm-hmm. more arguments if they wanted to. And if I remember it right, the statement is pretty broad of like, we should be allowed to be doing this under the First Amendment without getting very specific, mm-hmm. that, which to me goes to the cynical Evan side of, wait a minute, this just might just be for PR more than anything else, because it might not have a leg to stand on. Just want to say First Amendment and people go, their eyes light up and that means something to them.
We get right. All fuzzy and little hearts start coming out of our heads.
Yeah, like Care Bears.
You know, multicolored hearts, like, you know, green and yellow.
Yes, this doesn't really resemble a conventional motion or legal brief. It doesn't, it's, you know, has no real authoritative arguments within it.
It's just
or let
weird,
alone
weird,
you know,
procedure. You know, I mean, yeah. It's there's no case number. I mean, that just goes to the whole scariness of how opaque these proceedings are. I mean, I'm sure the lawyers who file it are expert in these things. Obviously, I mean, let me not overstate anything here. I mean, the lawyers at Google hire know what the heck they're doing in this, but it just goes to show this is weird procedural stuff. How to even bring
procedures
this
are secrets. Everything's yes. a secret.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's probably like exactly the form they need to file, but they can't prove that because the form that shows them how to do it is also a secret.
Subject to an order. Yeah.
All right. Well, someone who has been attempting to shed transparency on all this all along is Edward Snowden, of course. And as a follow-up to the original information that he gave to The Guardian and The Washington Post, he gave an exclusive Twitter-based Q&A to The Guardian, answered a bunch of questions, and shed some more light on what he thinks direct access means. I thought that was a pretty interesting part of the Q&A. He was asked a couple of questions about that. Define in as much detail as you can what direct access means, and can analysts listen to content of domestic calls without a warrant? So his answers basically say that the restrictions are not technical, that restrictions on accessing all the data that the NSA has are not technical, but they're policy-based and can change at any time. He also criticizes that audits of the whole system are cursory, incomplete, and easily fooled by fake justifications. He goes on to get to the content question. Glenn Greenwald followed up and asked him, when you say someone at NSA still has the content of your communications, what do you mean? Do you mean they have a record of it or the actual content? And he says both. If I target, for example, an email address, for example, under FAA 702, and that email address sent something to you, Joe America, the analyst gets it, all of it, IPs, raw data, content, headers, attachments, everything. And it gets saved for a very long time. It can be extended further with waivers rather than warrants. So he doesn't really address what exactly direct access means, but apparently what direct access means is, according to Edward Snowden, a method by which all your data are belong to us. Anybody else pull out anything from this Q&A that they want to talk about today on the show?
I really thought this was a great metaphor, and I'd never seen it before. So I don't know if this is original to Ed Snowden or whether he's borrowing it from somewhere else. But he was talking about how, you know, yes, we do enjoy some limited privacy protections, but these are just policy protections. You know, it's not a technological means of restricting an NSA contractor or employee's access to this information, but it's merely a policy protection, which means that policy could be open it up. And the metaphor that I really like, and that I'm going to, you know, keep and try to use it in conversation whenever I can, is that he says it's important to understand that policy protection is no protection. Policy is a one-way ratchet that only loosens. I think that's a really effective way of talking about how this, especially when you're dealing with the government, how it's just going to be, you know, they're going to learn what they want to learn, and they're not going to, on their own make their access more restricted to what they have the ability to know. That's why it's a ratchet that only loosens.
Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. It's funny, when I see stuff like this, the movie, for whatever reason, the movie that keeps coming back to my head is this movie, The Lives of Others, this German movie it's about the Stasi. And the thing that makes it so disturbing as a movie isn't even the fact that it's about a Stasi agent that's spying on this couple, isn't even so much the invasion of privacy per se part of it, but it's the part of it where he just, by virtue of being in their lives in the way that he is, becomes totally invested in them in this way that's completely unrelated to his nominal professional role. And so when you think about having analysts, giving analysts the ability to kind of get that involved in people's lives, even if you're willing to accept that there are situations where that is something you'd want to happen, there's just this huge human tendency to want to overreach, to want to abuse it, to want to get deeper. And so the idea that the things that prevent that tendency are some sort of non-technical rules that just ask you to be on your best behavior, which seems to be what he's describing, becomes really disturbing because it just keeps coming as, well, you can always push it a little bit further. You can always get a little bit more involved if you really want to. And it's human nature to want to. And so that's part of it that really disturbs me about this.
I asked any thoughts on Ed Snowden's interview with The Guardian?
Yeah, you know, I probably would have a lot more thoughts on it if I hadn't reached that, like, my saturation point for freakout.
Yes.
You know, like I all the story developing for the past several weeks, it's just kind of depressing to see that this all the tinfoil hat concepts were right, like that everyone is watching you, everything you're doing is watched, and everything can be kept forever, especially if you encrypted it or you're using a VPN or they think you're in a foreign land or any of those things. So I don't really have anything particular to say other than I've maxed out.
So, Michael, what do you think about this argument that the EFF hopes to successfully assert that the state secret defense goes out the window now that all this stuff is public in its ongoing quest to get more information about what's going on, more transparency about how these surveillance programs work? They're now arguing that... you know, now that it's not secret, there is no state secret defense. Do you think that'll go anywhere?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in the state secret defense, but I really hope it does. I mean, it's funny. Obviously, I'm living here in Washington, and over the past really couple of years, there's been a couple of very large leaks. And the leaks are public. They're on the internet. They're in the press. But a lot of the time, if you talk to somebody, just socially, you talk to someone who works in the government, they will say, I can't talk about that because that's still classified. And, you know, we can't talk about it. We can't acknowledge it, even though their agency has sometimes acknowledged or the administration has said, this is all true. And so allowing the government to maintain this fiction that something is secret, even when it's not, just because that's the convenient way they wish the world operated, seems really destructive. I mean, if you recognize that there's state secret privilege for a reason, which is that some things need to be secret, and that privilege comes at a cost, but the cost is worthwhile to preserve that secrecy. When the actual secrecy is gone, the mm-hmm. idea that cost should still be bared because of this idea that it's still marked secret just strikes me as kind of insane.
Evan, any response to that?
Well, you know, I think it's a bit of a dangerous argument to make for EFF to, I mean, it's not dangerous for them to make the argument, but if the court were to buy the argument, that might be a little bit dangerous. It's not exactly like the principle of saying that a person who kills their parents shouldn't get mercy on the court now that they're an orphan, because obviously EFF is not the one who did the leaking or the whistleblowing here. But at the same time, you know, just because the and I'm putting this in big air quotes, the damage has been done. That's obviously from an NSA apologist perspective, you know, the leaking of these facts, just because that's been, you know, that's out there now. Doesn't mean that the confidential secret nature of it should go away. There may be other reasons why the confidential secret nature of it ought to go away, but I'm not so sure that it's safe for us to say that ought to be the one. I mean, it's clearly a subtle issue, one that we would
need to think through.
Well, I mean, because there's more to be discerned about it. That, you know, they're to the extent that there is a negative, consequence of Snowden having disclosed this, you know, the disclosure of its secret nature perhaps isn't yet complete. And so why do we now need to go ahead and have the court sanction for it to be fully disclosed? Mind you, I'm just arguing this position just for the sake of our argument here. I'm not so sure I subscribe to it, but I'm just trying to, be cautious in endorsing, the EFF's argument, trying to look for some kind of consequence of it as well. But you raise a good point. If the cat is out of the bag, how much more can the cat get out of the bag if it's out of the bag?
Maybe the tail's still in there. Let's make cat out of the bag our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And I'm going to type it in so I don't forget it. Let's move on from the NSA and secrets about secrets to some other privacy-related stories. This one caught my eye. It seems, we're talking about whether the FISA court orders are too broad and unconstitutional. On a much more local state level, in New Jersey, the police officers, law enforcement would like the ability, and there's a bill pending to support this, to at an accident site when you've had a car accident, to look at your phone and see if you were texting while you were driving and if that caused the accident. And they would get access to what's on your phone, and they would be able to see whether you were texting or not. And the proponents of this bill liken it to being able to confiscate an open bottle of alcohol at the scene of an accident, even though there's nothing that's saying it had been consumed right before the event. They can do that sort of thing. So, Evan, do you think this is, if it is to pass, it is a pending bill, do you think it would be struck as unconstitutional, unreasonable search?
I don't know. I mean, there's case law that goes both ways as to whether or not you have a Fourth Amendment right of privacy in that, you know, it kind of goes to that whole analysis of whether it's a container, like a pack of cigarettes. You know, is that, you know, there's the way of analyzing the Fourth Amendment interest there. I think there could also be some First Amendment issues here, maybe some free associate, you know, the freedom to associate or something like that, you know, sure. But, you know, so this is a tough one to crack because, you know, I think the first way of teeing up the issue is that this is a serious problem. People get killed and maimed because of distracted driving. So this is a compelling government interest to make our roads safe from this. I mean, I could imagine that if somebody had had a loved one who was killed in a car accident because of a distracted driver, you would very easily come in support of this legislation. So I don't want to take anything away from that. At the same time, I'm not about to say that we need to compromise on our constitutional protections on this. So that leads me to the question, you know, is there any other possible way that law enforcement could be given the ability to determine whether somebody was texting right before they were driving without this nanny state kind of procedure that goes about where just like a parent would come in on a rebellious teenager and say, show me your phone. You know, what were you doing thumbing through that? God, that's just so repulsive to think of the government having that kind of power over us, a policeman having that kind of a power over an individual. I just hate that. So, you know, that's despicable to me. So then here's where it gets even more despicable. I can't quite get to a solution to this because, okay, another way of showing whether they had been texting is pull up their records. See what they were doing. You know, call up Verizon, have Verizon send over all the list of all the texts they had sent. So there we are with the same kind of privacy concerns that we have, you know, with all this stuff that's been making us mad for a couple weeks now. So I don't know how to get to this. All I know is just it's a very important issue. People are dying and being maimed and losing, you know, substantial quality of life because of distracted driving. So there's something that's got to be done. I don't know quite sure what it is. This may or may not be the right thing.
Well, the other thing, the mobile messaging market is so fractured. There's like WhatsApp and then there's iMessages and then there's Facebook messages. You could use pretty much anything. So the thing is, once this police officer has your phone, are they going to have the right to go through every single application or are they just looking at your SMS? What exactly is the limits of something like this? Because like Evan was saying about the association aspect, if you were, let's say, Facebook messaging, that's going to open up your Facebook profile. You're going to see who your friends are. There's a lot more data in there than just texting somebody. So it just seems technologically very strange how this would be implemented. Do we all have to keep all our messaging apps in one folder now, or how is that even going to work?
I have the feeling, you know, the argument would be made, I think, Ayaz, based on exactly what you're saying, that they would have some pretty broad access to your phone to go through and check all those various ways that you could have been distracted while driving. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have to be texting. What if you're, you know, using the Maps app to find your way and glancing down at your phone instead of heads up on the road? So, yeah, I mean, it's. I think they would have very broad access to your phone. I haven't read the text of the bill, but I don't see how the bill makes sense without giving them some pretty broad access.
Yeah, it seems like it opens up just a huge can of worms. Also, everything else, like Twitter or you're saying your Maps app, or pretty much anything could be distracting you. So that could be your entire device. That's a little strange.
Right. Maybe New Jersey should just, you know, enact a law that everyone use Google Glass instead when they're driving, and then their hands will be firmly on.
Delaware's trying to outlaw Google Glass, though.
Yeah. Exactly.
Dude, when you drive from Delaware to New Jersey, it's a switch from your phone to your Google Glass, depending on what side of the border you're on.
Just
big science.
Keep it right there in your sunglasses case. All right, let's move on. A couple more privacy stories before we wrap the show. Just real quickly, Twitter, which was not on the PRISM list and has definitely had a wonderful track record in attempting to keep users' identities private unless absolutely forced to, was absolutely forced to in France recently. A group of Jewish students in France sued to have the identities revealed of various people who were posting anti-Semitic tweets. And Twitter, I think, has lost at two levels of the French court system now. There was a trial court that ordered them to produce the names and in an appellate court as well now. So Twitter's going to have to cough that up unless they say they're considering their options and may perhaps resubmit the appeal. But, you know, unless they get some last minute reprieve from the court, they're going to have to disclose the identities of those individuals holding those Twitter accounts. Evan, Twitter did pretty much everything they could here, huh?
I guess so. Maybe they should have to turn over the information. When I tweeted this, I called it a dumb decision because maybe I just didn't read it as closely as I should have. And I thought that what the decision was is that Twitter could potentially be liable for the defamatory content. And I'm not so sure the court's decision doesn't say that. But I think what happened here is that the court's being ordered to turn over the identifying information. And maybe they should. You know, if this is unlawful under French law, I'm not even going to begin to, you know, go on any more commentary of the, you know, that whole issue, then maybe, you know, they should be required to turn over that information if the right showing has been made. I think it would be interesting to see if there was a judgment from a French court in all of this, if that was to be tried to enforce that in the United States. We've got that federal statute, I forget what it's called, but, you know, that did away with you know, the tourism, the libel tourism, you know, President Obama signed it a few years ago. So I know that the provisions of that act make it so that if something was going to, be contrary to the protections of Section 230 or otherwise contrary to U.S. law, that it wouldn't be enforceable. So, you know, I guess I need to think about this a little bit more. I'm going to officially retract what I said when I tweeted about this story a couple of days ago, that it was dumb, because maybe it wasn't, it's probably not a decision that a U.S. court would make, but maybe it wasn't necessarily dumb. I just don't know.
Yeah, it seems to me, I'm definitely not an expert on what's legal and not legal in France, but that the purpose here seems to be to have the identities of the users so that, you know, to put name with scurrilous statement and shame, embarrass, perhaps educate, but and perhaps prosecute the people in question. So I don't know if I have a so. It seems like a very strange result to me. But again, you know, French law is French law, and I'm definitely not someone trained in it. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my mind, I kind of separate the two things out, right? Is should there be, as a general proposition, is it okay that there's a legal process to identify anonymous people in some instances? Sure. You know, we see that in the United States all the time. There's certainly situations where that's fine. And then the question is kind of, well, is a speech-related offense, you know, offense in air quotes, justification for implementing that process? In the United States, the answer would be no. In France, my understanding of French law is that it is, and you could, in fact, be prosecuted. And if you're willing to accept that France can pass a law like that because they are not subject to the U.S. Constitution, then I don't know how you can get up in arms about having the second half of the law that allows them to identify anonymous speakers. So, you know, it wouldn't be the way that I might set up my legal system, but I don't see it as sort of like a fundamentally unjust way to operate the law.
Right. Ayaz, any thoughts on this?
I'm going to stick with your guys' points. I'm not an expert in French law, but if this is the law of France and this is what they can do, then Twitter has to comply. And basically, if Twitter wants to tick off a whole country, we've seen France have issues with lots of different companies, Amazon, Google. I don't know if Twitter wants to be on that list. I guess they got to comply.
All right. Well, moving from France to Sweden, I thought this was really a fascinating law that's being proposed in Sweden. Again, you know, maybe Mike Masnick writes it up and has the take on it that it's designed to or will have a primary impact of preventing people from policing government officials, be they officers or politicians or whatever. That's not what I get from the law. I see it more as, you know, sort of another instance of moral panic and people concerned about what technology accomplishes these days vis-a-vis privacy. But anyway, the law itself would ban taking pictures and filming in a quote-unquote private environment without first getting permission from people in attendance. Someone like my husband would love this law. You know, he hates that I take pictures and put them on Twitter. And, you know, he has no say-so over that except for to yell at me after the fact. So, you know, I see it more designed for people who don't want themselves put out there without their permission. Mike casts it as, you know, this is a maybe a backhanded attempt to address the fact that public officials are being filmed in ways that they don't want to be. Evan, what's your take?
I think this is just another way of looking at the interests or the issues of the right to be forgotten. It's like the right to not even be perceived in the first place before the memory is lodged in one's consciousness. So, you know, I think the principles are the same there. It's just that, you know, looking at it from a different temporal perspective, future versus past. It certainly would have helped Mitt Romney in the 47% video if that was here in the U.S. So, you know. I would just do the same analysis as I would for the right to be forgotten, and, you know, critique that for its free speech implications and balance that against the individual dignitary interest of the individual.
Well, and that's one of the things that Mike points out, is that if you're in a situation like that, you know, how do you decide what is a private environment? You know, if you're at a fundraising event where only people who have paid to get in are there, then perhaps that would be a private environment. So if you're determined to get consent, you have to go around and, you know, have everybody in the room sign something. What constitutes consent seems rather vague as well. Michael, what do you think?
I mean, it's hard to tell. This is an article that is a write-up of another article that is taking a Swedish proposed bill or a law now. So I suspect a lot of the nuances dropped out. I would hope that the Swedes had thought through some of the issues that are kind of blindingly obvious when you think about it. It seems like there are a lot of enforcement problems. This would be a really good selective enforcement tool. But I think I agree with Evan in the sense that this probably comes back to the way I think of it as the difference between a U.S. concept of privacy and a European concept of privacy. And this strikes me as a very strange thing to try to legislate, but it's probably because from the United States standpoint, it would be a very strange thing, but it's not an inherently wrong thing to legislate, although the practicalities of it do seem to be not so easy to deal with.
Ayaz, what do you think? I mean, people do get so up in arms about being captured in private settings and put on social media. If such a law were proposed in the United States, do you think it would have a chance, especially because the entire social media corporate world would rise up against it?
I think state by state basis probably get away with it with, you know, there's some screwier places. But when I saw this story, it just screamed Google Glass to me. It's like a knee-jerk reaction of, oh my gosh, you're going to have a camera on your face. Yeah, it's become a lot easier to have a camera, you know, on your phone and everything else. Every other device has a camera on it at this point. But this idea that I'm looking at somebody with a device that has a camera right here, I think the publicity of Google Glass maybe made this kind of law or this kind of proposed law. This is why this thing exists. It's a knee-jerk reaction to people freaking out of, oh no, you're recording me right now, even though those devices are very obvious at this point. And it's just a new reality of everybody's got a camera. And if this is a law somewhere, and this actually does become, this is the way it is, what's a private event? I don't know. Do I have to have like a sign once you're over 30 people that's public? Do I have to like start wearing like an earring that glows green that you can take pictures of me all the time? Like, I don't know how you actually implement this in a way. And then you have all these lawsuits that could come after this, which would create a huge glut for courts. It seems really kind of unworkable.
You see, what'll be awesome is someday we'll all have RFID chips that will transmit to everyone else around it, even different layers of privacy, different tiers of how much you consent to being filmed, photographed, what have you. And here's where it gets really cool, is that can be integrated into invisibility cloaks. And so it will only activate when certain parameters have been met. And if you don't want to be filmed, you know, the person can go ahead and film you, but it'll look like you aren't there because of your invisibility cloak. That's where it'll really get cool.
Yeah, well, here in Washington.
You're making a joke, but that sounds like something very much in line with what vendor relationship management and the working group at Harvard is working toward, a way of, you know, being able to tell the world the various permissions about your data and your privacy that you want applied to you. So, you know, I mean, it sounds funny, but don't laugh, you know, wait a decade. To answer your question, Ayaz, it appears that this law was passed by Sweden's parliament and goes into effect on July 1st.
So I guess you guys are right. Then you're going to have a smartphone app that just publishes out your privacy statements constantly.
Right.
Or like maybe it'll scramble cameras. Who knows?
Michael, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, you know, here in Washington, you get a lot of invitations to events. And at the bottom, they say this is a widely attended event. And that's because there are campaign finance rules about those sorts of things. So maybe people will start sending out invitations. And then at the bottom, it will say this is a public event or this is a private event in sort of a bizarre and blindingly obvious way. It's like I'm invited. Of course, this is going to be a widely attended event.
I don't know. You're on some pretty exclusive lists, I think, Michael.
Oh, yes, they're incredibly exclusive, let me tell you.
All right, so we have a tip of the week for you that it's actually a tip of the week, not for you, but for any government body gathering information. And that tip is, if you're going to collect it, you may have to cough it up. Now, Evan, you were talking about in our New Jersey phone scrutiny story we were discussing a second ago that you'd have to go to Verizon to maybe get the data of who was texting when they were driving. There's nothing that says you couldn't go to the NSA for that kind of material, too. And someone down in Florida has done so. In fact, filed a request. He is being prosecuted for a robbery, and he's defending himself for having, in a case involving, I think, it's a bank robbery. Bank robbery. I think it was maybe an armored car that was in jeopardy here, and he wanted to get at NSA records that he recently learned might have been maintained that went back further than actual phone records or anything else that he could gain access to. So they stayed the trial and filed a request with the NSA. They have since learned, however, that the NSA says, no, we don't have anything. That the NSA actually responded and said the program did not capture information about where a cellular telephone was geographically located at the time the call was made. He wanted to show I couldn't have possibly done this crime. So the government does not possess the records the defendant seeks. But you could envision the scenario that the government would have records that could be exculpatory or otherwise relevant in litigation or criminal proceedings. So, if you're going to collect it, government, you better, you know, our tax dollars at work are going to have to hire a whole bunch of people to manage these data requests, I think, that people like Mr. Brown here in Florida were creative enough to launch. Evan, any thoughts on this?
I don't want to comment. He was my cousin, so I don't want to say anything about it. No, he wasn't.
Yes.
I mean, the bigger risk here is the getting the information from the private actors, because they're under less restrictions than what the government is. I think it's intriguing. You know, I just don't know this area of the law, but I suspect that there's plenty of case law from just ordinary criminal enforcement to say that just because the government may have collected something doesn't mean that you're necessarily entitled to it. There would be some kind of privilege attached to that. I'm totally making this up. This is just Evan on the law right now. So, but that's the way that I would evaluate and analyze this and, you know, trying to develop some kind of strategy if I were the government trying to go against this. And then there's all kinds of policy reasons why the government wouldn't want to be in the business of supplying evidence to criminal defendants. I mean, that would just be, as you suggest, Denise, you'd have to really put our tax dollars at work and hire an army of, you know, bureaucrats, you know, hire 10 million more bureaucrats just to sit there and hand out, tap the NSA database and hand out information about defendants. That does not seem like a real efficient enterprise. So I would imagine that somehow this would this practice would be put to bed pretty quickly. But, you know, stranger things happen in reality, I guess.
It was interesting to me that the government even responded to this request, and they did. So, you know, setting the precedent that perhaps they will have to respond in the future, or that they would respond in the future. Michael, any thoughts?
I'll defer to Evan Law on this one. I think that's, yeah, I mean, if the government has something and they are the ones prosecuting you, do they have a burden to turn it over, even if it's a completely different part of the government? And this is, right. I guess, a state case. It doesn't matter because the state government is not the same government that's spying on you. But I think the general principle that if you are collecting something that creates some burdens for you is good. I don't know that it applies this far.
I think actually this was a federal case because he was, was it?
He's a super robber? I don't know.
Let me double check this. One second to get the other link up. Yeah, I think it's a federal court because, U.S. District Judge Robin Rosenbaum presiding. So
then it would be relevant, but I still don't know the answer.
Right. Okay. So let us, I just wanted to say too, I just think it's ironic that, you know, Google and others who hold data have had to deal with this problem for a long time and will continue to have to deal with the problem. So if the government is going to be such an actor as well, then they're going to have to figure out the logistics of responding to evidence requests as well. Getting back to our resource of the week here, it relates to the story we did at the top of the show about 3D printing and Creative Commons licenses. Creative Commons licenses in general, over at Plagiarism Today, Jonathan Bailey has a nice piece on the problem with Creative Commons licenses, helping people understand that while Creative Commons licenses are wonderful, great way to find content, you have to take them with a grain of salt because the person applying the license may have applied it either wrongfully or mistakenly, and may not understand the law well enough to know that the work that they have created may not be something in which they have all the rights. So definitely go check it out. In addition to the various teaching moments that we talked about earlier, about needing to know the scope of the license, you need to actually be very comfortable with the fact that the work in question was actually capable of being licensed at all. So go check out Jonathan's article about that if you are someone who works a lot with Creative Commons licenses. And with that, we're getting up to the top of the hour here, guys. So we're going to need to sign off and shelve some of these great stories for another time, but it's been a great pleasure chatting with you all today. Michael, always a pleasure getting your thoughts and insights.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
And Ayaz, always fun to have you on the show. Thank you for taking time away from all of your other projects at Twit.
Thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you guys. Learning is always great. Every time I'm on the show, I learn a ton. So thanks for having me on.
It's been really fun. I think we may have lost Evan. Am I right that we lost Evan? He was having some Skype issues.
Yes,
so,
he did.
So I will merely thank Evan for all of his great contributions to the show and remind you that he writes a great blog called Internet Cases, where you can get his take on various developments in the realm of internet and technology law between the shows. And he is Internet Cases on Twitter as well. I'm Dee Howell over there. So that's a great way to get in touch with us between the shows. You can also email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. He is Evan at twit.tv. And check us out on Facebook and Google Plus as well. We post up stuff there as we are prepping the show. And we love to get your thoughts on the things that we should cover. And we really appreciate everyone who contacts us there and helps us get the show together each week. Michael, is there anything in particular you want to tell us about going on at Public Knowledge before we go ahead and wrap?
No, I think we've got all this 3D printing stuff. There's cell phone unlocking. There's all sorts of crazy future of the internet network and spectrum things. But check out our blog at publicknowledge.org/blog to see all the things that are happening, because lots of things are happening in Washington that impact the internet right now.
That's great. We will definitely do that. And Ayaz, I think we helped you get some programming for know-how on this show that the geeks of the world can help, such as yourself, can help the parents of the world navigate at least how to provide some non-sensorial, effective, intuitive, and easy to use internet filtering, maybe?
Something like that. If you guys aren't aware, I do a show called Know How. It's a how-to show on Twit. We do it every Thursday. And if you'd like to know how to create things or how to change things in your tech world, that's what we do. And that project you guys are talking about, using OpenDNS to filter internet on a router level, we have to do that. It's actually, we have a Google Plus community. They've actually explained how to do it to me. So they've written it out by themselves. And I'm like, hey, these guys are brilliant. So they're participating. I'm getting to learn. And we're going to show you that in, I don't know, a couple of weeks. We're scheduled out till August right now. So I guess I'll find out when I'm doing it soon enough.
Let me know when you're doing that one, because I have so many friends and colleagues in the in my local community here who are definitely going to want to watch that.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone. We're so thrilled that you joined us for This Week in Law. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. Please join us when you can, and look for us at twit.tv/twill, on YouTube, in iTunes, etc. if you can't join us live. We'll see you next time on This Week in Law.